Welcome to Ask the Investigator, brought to you by the Journal of Drugs and Dermatology. The JDD podcast illuminates timely scientific content through thoughtful discussion with top dermatology authors. Subscribe to the Journal of Drugs and Dermatology at jddonline.com to browse the current issue and evidence-based peer-reviewed archives.
Welcome to the fifth and final episode of the five-part All Things Atopic Dermatitis series. I'm your host, Dr. Adam Friedman, professor and chair of dermatology at GW School of Medicine and Health Sciences. This podcast series is supported by an independent medical education grant provided by Sanofi Genzyme and Regeneron. So to round out this series, we have two heavy, may I say, major hitters in the atopic dermatitis world. First up is Dr. Amy Paller, who is chair of the Department of Dermatology, director of the Skin Biology and Diseases Resource-Based Center, and the Walter J. Hamlin Professor of Dermatology at Northwestern. She spends her time in the lab studying the role of topically applied nanotherapy-based gene therapies to treat skin diseases, particularly diabetic ulcers, psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, skin cancer, and rare genetic skin problems. Dr. Paller has led almost 100 clinical trials. Her most recent translational research has defined the immunophenotypes in early atopic dermatitis in children, paving the way for targeted therapy, some of which we'll discuss today, and discovered the immune dysregulation that may lead to inflamed skin and ichthyoses, leading to a novel clinical trial with repurposed medication. Next on deck is Dr. Jonathan Silverberg, who is an associate professor of dermatology at the GW School of Medicine and Health Sciences. He serves as director of clinical research and contact dermatitis. Dr. Silverberg's area of clinical subspecialty is inflammatory skin disease, particularly atopic and contact dermatitis. He has extensive experience in the advanced management of atopic dermatitis, hand eczema, chronic itch, psoriasis, hidradenitis, and many other chronic inflammatory skin disorders. He is also a national expert in allergy patch testing, photo testing, and photo patch testing. Of note, Dr. Silverberg is also the chair of the annual Revolutionizing Atopic Dermatitis Global Multidisciplinary Conference. In this episode, we will review current moderate to severe atopic dermatitis treatment approaches and use of systemic therapies. We will also discuss advancements on AD clinical management with novel targeted therapies and share clinical experience with the use of biologic treatment. In response to the current public health situation, faculty will address the growing concerns surrounding dermatology-related immunosuppressant therapy, how to address this issue with patients, and the benefits of targeted therapy for AD during the COVID-19 pandemic. For a complete description of this podcast, please check out the website as well as for the full list of faculty disclosures. Welcome, Drs. Paller and Silverberg. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's good to be here.
So let's jump right in. I mean, I feel like I'm dealing with the Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle of atopic dermatitis here. And so I imagine when patients make their way to you, whether it's by referral or they've read an article or some media interaction, very often they're coming to you because they may have seen other dermatologists or other doctors and haven't gotten the treatment they think they need for the severity of their disease. And they say they need something new, something advanced, maybe something systemic. Dr. Paul, let's start with you. How do you approach these patients who may be candidates for systemic therapies? And how do you kind of talk to them about that?
Well, thanks, Adam. Anyone who comes to see me, obviously, is going to be a child or adolescent with atopic dermatitis. And I don't always just jump in by starting with the systemics. It's really important to have an understanding of what the treatment regimens have been in the past that have not led to success. There are so many times when, for example, a family thinks that they're doing something that's as aggressive as can possibly be, and it's actually a mild topical steroid, or situations where you have a family that's really just not really understanding how to treat. And so the treatment has been inadequate, and it just takes some education. Obviously, we're going to make sure that there's not some reason for lack of success, like infection or perhaps a contact dermatitis or even a wrong diagnosis, which doesn't happen too often with atopic dermatitis. There may be a situation in which an adolescent is just really not putting on the topicals that were prescribed. But in a situation like that, it can be very hard to turn that around without either a lot of good buy-in for that adolescent or thinking very creatively. So I'll always start with thinking about whether there's something more I can do that just hasn't been done that makes sense for that family before advancing to systemic therapy. But then I'll go on to systemic therapy. And fortunately, we have some new agents and new directions to go in that are facilitating our treating of children and adolescents with greater effectiveness and certainly greater safety as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, especially given your patient population, you're not just having a conversation with the patient, you're having it with the family. And, you know, I think we sometimes take for granted, especially in adult dermatology, but even with some of the other inflammatory dermatoses like psoriasis, where oral systemics, even biologics, have been part of the lexicon for some time. How do you talk to them about initiating a systemic therapy?
Frankly, it's much easier now to talk about initiating a systemic therapy than it was 5 years ago, even when our choices were the immunosuppressants. We try to avoid systemic steroids whenever we can, particularly in a child. But the idea of having to introduce cyclosporin, even when then transitioning that to something like methotrexate, really involved a discussion of agents that suppress the immune system, that require monitoring on a regular basis with blood testing, which is not pleasant for families to have to deal with. And so it's so much easier now that we actually have at least one agent out there that although it requires an injection to be given, really is not associated with safety issues that we're concerned about and does not require blood testing. It's not easy to have to talk about giving a child a shot, giving a systemic medicine, and there still are concerns because, above all, families are concerned about safety. But nevertheless, we now have agents that give wonderful effectiveness and have a wonderful safety record without the requirement for blood draws. And that makes a big difference to families.
You know, I'll direct the same question to you, Dr. Silverberg. You know, with your adult patients, many of whom would never have assumed a systemic agent would ever be employed, especially an injection for their skin rash, how do you talk to them about not just the drug, but like what the need is, why we're doing this? How do you kind of present it to them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And first, I have to say, it's a very tough act to follow, Dr. Paller. because I think a lot of those principles are true for the adults as well. But there seem to be some differences between the adult and the pediatric patients in certain respects. They may be a little bit more open to risk. You know, they're a little bit less risk averse than the parents of some of our younger patients. And I think that's logical. On the other hand, it's very hard to educate or to introduce a new therapy to somebody who's had disease for 40 plus years. You know, for that middle-aged patient who has seen countless doctors, they're convinced that, you know, even at that age, there's still that magical food. If they could find it, everything would get better, you know, and it's really hard to explain, like, you know, why, how to optimize some of the topical therapies, like even getting back to your first question about what was a topical failure. You know, there's a lot of preconceived notions and habits that set in over the years, and trying to reset that can be very challenging. I do think, though, that if you're offering them something new, and many times patients really just, they want something new. They want to hear an option that they have not heard before, that in general, they are open to it. And then it comes down to that shared decision-making conversation about, you know, what fits best with their values. Some will say, look, safety first. That's all that matters to me. And I don't care if I take a shot that might be a bit uncomfortable. Others say, listen, I want this itch better tomorrow. And it's I can't predict it. And that's why we have to have that dialogue with patients and really try to assess patient preference and then sort of tailor the recommendations to that. But I second what Dr. Paller mentioned, which is, you know, having these new options in both our newly approved, or recently approved injectable medications and a very rich pipeline of things coming, it gives us new things to be able to discuss with patients in a disease where until recently we had nothing new to talk about for decades.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And one of the things I say to patients is, especially with you know our new injectable agent, is that this is a purposely designed medication for your condition, that all the stuff we've been using in the past, even the topical steroids, you know, their indications for steroid responsive dermatoses, you know, even patients who have been on oral immunosuppressants or light, you know, this is now a therapeutic that takes the underpinnings of their disease into consideration. And I think there's some validation that comes with that, that someone's been thinking about their condition, something that's been driving them crazy, and is purposely designing something for them. And that I think has been helpful with getting some patients on board. But I think we've all also have hit some roadblocks in the last year or so with the pandemic. And I'm curious to hear, and Dr. Silberbaum, I'll start with you. How has the pandemic changed your approach to observing, evaluating, and then treating these moderate to severe patients?
So it's a great question. In a sense, it changed nothing. And in a sense, it changed everything. early on, the biggest challenge was just not knowing anything, you know, not having any evidence in favor or against using any of these medications. There was a lot of sort of guessing in the field that everything would be fine if you just continue on your, you know, systemic or biologic agents, and we don't have anything to worry about. We really didn't have any data to guide some of that. And early on, patients just didn't want to come in for visits at all, right? They just wanted to stay away from the healthcare setting as far as they could. But, you know, for most of our treatments, we at least haven't seen any major signals of concern. It doesn't mean that we have evidence, you know, full-blown evidence to suggest that everything is, you know, perfect to just continue business as usual throughout, in the setting of COVID. But we certainly don't have any data that are discouraging either. So I think once things settled down and we were able to get back into a rhythm with treating patients and patients were willing to come back in, my approach was relatively the same. I didn't change that much in terms of how I was deciding things. The one thing I would say, if anything, I was trying to keep patients away from phototherapy, because especially for a lot of our underserved patients who would be coming by public transportation, I just felt that that might be more risky than being hunkered down and socially distanced on an immunosuppressant, because they'll get exposed to people more. But what did change for me is the sort of the workflow. And, you know, we reintroduced, a fair amount of teledermatology, because there's a lot of intensive counseling that's required. And, you know, to sit in the room for 30 minutes with somebody is potentially a high risk exposure. And it's really turned out to be a beautiful thing, because we're able to really provide that counseling in a safe way. And, you know, once we know the diagnosis and we're comfortable with the fundamentals and we understand the level of severity, teledermatology can really be a wonderful thing for monitoring how patients are doing. And most patients actually prefer it in certain respects over having to come in live once they have already established care. And I found also that we really have the opportunity to then supplement using, you know, patient-reported outcomes, different tools to assess how well they're doing as really a way to make teledermatology work well. So from my choice of therapies, I guess not much has changed, but in the how we've gone about it, a lot has changed, and I think hopefully for the better.
Oh, that's great. Dr. Paller, what about you?
I can't say that I disagree with anything that Dr. Silberberg just said. I love this concept of a lot has changed and a lot hasn't changed. Because it's the same thing, the great uncertainty at the beginning. It's a bit of difference in children, because of course so many of our children and adolescents have had a disease that's not been symptomatic when it comes to COVID. We don't even know that they've had it. I can't say that I've had but one patient in my entire last few months, and I'm seeing everybody in person for the most part, who's had COVID and called because of any kind of symptoms whatsoever. But we find out when they come into the office that the parents had it, you know, everybody else in the family had it, but the child never had it. And the likelihood is that that child really did have it, but didn't show symptoms. And we've had other situations where children with moderate to severe disease who are on systemics have tested positive for COVID, but haven't manifested anything. So with at least the agents that we're currently using, and again, I will say that we don't tend to use systemic steroids in children, and certainly with dupilumab, but even those on methotrexate, the few that I know of have had COVID and not had any kind of symptoms. With respect to teledermatology, we are using it with a few patients who really don't want to come in, but most of our patients do want to be seen. That said, there's nothing better than those patients who you've seen for years with their terrible atopic dermatitis, who've started on a systemic agent and are now doing so well that they can just show you a little bit on their ankle, for example, because that's all that they have. And the appointments are so much shorter because of the result of highly effective therapy.
Yeah, you know, I'm with you both. I think purposefully using teledermatology in the right setting has limitless benefits for both sides. I mean, you know, it was mentioned avoiding possible contact by traveling to the office, but even the cost and the time that takes away from one's day to do that, there's so many benefits to that. It's more about picking the right scenario. I mean, I think those easy follow-ups of the patients, you know, you can close your eyes and imagine their skin because you've seen them for so long. Telemedicine is a great option. Hopefully we can maintain this with the waived restrictions in place. But I'm glad both of you brought that up because I think many kind of stray away from telemedicine. It's not a comfort zone. There's certainly scenarios where it doesn't work, but I think this is one of those great examples, especially for monitoring long-term systemic therapy, where it can be a huge win. And you know, along the lines of systemic therapy, I just want to spend a little bit of time on some of our oldie but goodies. And Dr. Powell, I'd love to start with you with methotrexate, because I feel like anytime I talk about methotrexate at a meeting, I'm always citing some of your studies, especially in kids. What has been your experience? And I'd love some maybe practical pearls for those listening of how to implement it if you are going to go that route, especially in the pediatric population.
It's true that in children, we use a fair amount of methotrexate. So thanks for asking that question. I will say, though, that the problem with methotrexate is really not so much its safety as how long it can take to get started in working. And that means I either have to start with something like cyclosporin or start with systemic steroids and then have to taper over time, trying to avoid rebound while at the same time I start methotrexate. What I've largely done with trying to get someone who can't be on, for example, dupilumab, which I would prefer as first-line therapy for whatever reason, and perhaps that means that they've tried dupilumab and it hasn't been effective enough, is I will most commonly start with cyclosporin. I've not had very many problems with it in children. I wouldn't want to continue it for long periods of time, but it sure is faster and it allows me to avoid systemic steroids. So I'll start with cyclosporin. I'll get somebody under control over the first 3 or 4 months if all goes well. And then I will have an overlap period of a month or maybe two as I'm tapering a dose to get them onto the methotrexate, which I'm more comfortable continuing for a few years. I've seen very little problem with methotrexate in terms of safety, primarily the GI toxicity, maybe some fatigue with it. So it's safe. I've had little in the way of lab abnormalities other than sometimes evidence in some of the obese patients. And yes, those with atopic dermatitis can have obesity, who've had some issues with liver transaminase elevations. But otherwise, it works fairly well, but takes longer. I've even had some patients who, when dupilumab came out, they were doing so well on methotrexate that they just wanted to stay on it for a little longer till there was more experience. I've transitioned most of them off because I do like the idea of not having to do any laboratory testing and feeling that much safer about long-term use. But it's been a useful workhorse, especially for those who need an immunosuppressant.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the need for that bridge is starting tricky. And I think for me, that's the only place where I'll use systemic steroids in these patients to buy them time while the methotrexate kicks in. And that's true, I think, of certain other medications that just are a little slow to start. Dr. Silverberg, pick your poison, literally and figuratively. You know, which of the oldies do you tend to lean heavier on? You know, when dupilumab may not be an option.
Yeah, so it's a great question, and I'm not sure there's exactly a one size fits all answer. I completely agree. If I'm going the route of a methotrexate for the longer term route, then you definitely need to cool them off with something else first, and that's going to be a cyclosporin. Usually, I don't like using systemic steroids for much. So, and so if I can use cyclosporin, I'll use cyclosporin. You know, it depends. If someone just needs a cooling off of a severe flare, then cyclosporin might be that better option if they tend to have a little bit more intermittent disease. You know, just case in point, I had a patient who was pretty mild for years and then lost her mother. And then within 24 hours was erythrodermic from the stress of it. And to the point where we were like, not sure, should we like hospitalize her instead of letting her go to her mother's funeral? And cyclosporin, you know, it was a quick fix. And she couldn't stay on it long term, but it was a quick fix. So I think it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. When I got a methotrexate, though, there's a particular challenge that happens with adults, and that's dosing. Because when you look at a lot of the studies that are done for methotrexate in atopic derm, they're focusing on peds. And so they'll test doses like 7.5 milligrams, which is, you know, like your low dose rheumatoid arthritis dose. And the problem is that dose just doesn't work in adults. Like it doesn't at all work in adults. And so I tend to use a weight-based dosing for the adults, starting at around 0.25 milligrams per kilogram. And if you look at the rheum literature, it might push to 0.5 milligram per kilogram per week. And, you know, for your obese patients, it's a little cringeworthy to have them on, you know, 50 milligrams of methotrexate. But you're just not going to see any value at 7.5. So I think that's a particular nuance, is to recognize that the old doses or the pediatric doses, which might work great, 7.5 milligrams for a lightweight child, they're just not going to do much, especially even in the large adolescents, but certainly for the full size adult who is way outside that weight category, you need to aim higher.
And let me just clarify that in children, I would never start at anything less than 0.3 milligrams per kilogram per week of methotrexate. I don't tend to use a test dose. Maybe I'm bold, but I know there's controversy about that. Nevertheless, we'll go up to even 0.7 per kilo per week in children and up to 30 in adolescents, and sometimes even go to the injectable, as we routinely do for our rheumatology patients.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because, you know, I feel like there's, I don't want to say confusion in the literature, but you know, you're familiar with some of the studies that tested a fixed dose of 7.5 milligrams and found reasonable control. Yeah, for a lighter weight child, that probably is about 0.3 milligram per kilogram per week, you know, but I'm so glad that you mentioned that even in the ped space that you're thinking about a weight-based dosing.
Yeah, I don't know anybody who doesn't use weight-based dosing for pediatrics. It really makes sense. And I will say also that I think that the folic acid dosing is very important. We just did a study in psoriasis that was international, and part of it was comparing the dosing of the folic acid, which often in Europe has been 5 milligrams weekly given in a single dose the day after methotrexate dosing, whereas we in the United States tend to do more like 1 milligram 6 or 7 days a week. And there was found to be a very significant increase relatively in the GI intolerance in the European dosing. And it wasn't the total dose. It wasn't anything else that we could find. It was merely the once per week versus 6 to 7. So just a caveat to remember to give it 6 or 7 times a week if you're dealing with folic acid as an attempt to reduce the particularly GI toxicity.
No, that's a great practical pearl. So, you know, now that we actually do have an FDA-approved medication for atopic dermatitis, Dupi, I mean, I feel like we could easily spend 20, 30 minutes just talking about the data and the experience. I would love to ask each of you some practical pearls to share with our audience related to your experiences, maybe things you just picked up anecdotally as you've been using it more and more, or things to look out for, things to consider. Dr. Silverberg, I'll start with you on this one.
You know, I think the nature of my practice has changed over the past few years. A few years ago, before, you know, Dupi was on the market or just when it entered into the market, I was seeing patients who, you know, languished for decades on topicals and were miserable. And I was the hero who put them on Dupi. Now I'm seeing the so-called Dupi failures. And you know, those are hard patients. And the first thing I do in those cases is I go back to the fundamentals and I question the diagnosis. I mean, I have no doubts in most of these cases that they always had atopic derm or may have had long-standing atopic derm. But then, you know, you have to worry about the possibility of an overlapping contact dermatitis. Could they have developed mycosis fungoides, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma? You know, so there's a lot of complexities. And you know, Dr. Pala mentioned earlier that in the pediatric space, usually the diagnosis is correct for atopic derm. It's much harder when you're dealing with the adult onset cases of atopic derm where, you know, you just can't prove it, but you know something's odd about the case and you're worried about MF, but the biopsy doesn't tell it to you. So, you know, I just always think about if a patient, even if they respond initially, but if they, after 2-3 months and beyond that, are not responding to Dupi, you know, go back to the basics. Rethink the diagnosis, make sure you're not missing anything, because, you know, Dupi is a very good drug for atopic dermatitis, but it's a terrible drug for psoriasis. It's not what it's designed for. So if there's a misdiagnosis, you need to know that. So I think to me, that's what I see now more than anything in these really complex patients. But of course, you know, the other issues that we routinely deal with would be, you know, the conjunctivitis issues, the red face of dupilumab, where it can manifest in different ways, but they'll get, you know, either usually it's asymptomatic, but sometimes symptomatic red lesions on the face that look more like sebderm or SIBO psoriasis. And they're not always easy to treat. Fortunately, if they're asymptomatic, the patients don't mind as much as they could if it was intensely itchy. But those can definitely be some concerning issues to try to work through.
I certainly agree with everything Dr. Silverberg just said. I'm going to add some that may be a little bit more pediatric specific. So one thing is you got to think about the immunizations. We really don't have any evidence yet that immunizations that are live are safe in anyone, let alone in children. So I try to broach that since it's more likely to be used in that population. And especially as we go down further in age to what the current approval is, that's something to keep in mind, trying to do it at least 1 month before starting. It's important, just as we talked about with methotrexate, to not transition abruptly. So even though people don't think their topicals are doing anything, even though the systemic medication that they're on is not doing enough, I always remind them to stay on the medication and have a transitional period, because the dupilumab, as we well know, can take some time to start. In some people, it's very quick, but in others, it may take a few months and may even continue. That's been our experience in children, to have greater effectiveness over time, even after the first few months. It's important to keep them on long enough too, as a result. So I can usually tell by 2 months out, if they're even showing some improvement, that they're likely by 3-4 months out to be at a place where we're happy. But I do want to continue for long enough. One thing that people worry about is the eye changes. We always have an ophthalmologist lined up to see somebody quickly, but I also have been starting, without any evidence base to do this, putting bland eye drops or ointment into the eyes in children and adolescents. And that's because of the interesting caveat that only those who have atopic dermatitis in trials who've been on dupilumab have gotten the conjunctival injection, not those with asthma or other atopic disorders. And that suggests there may be some barrier defect. And indeed, there have been shown to be fewer mucin-producing goblet cells. And I will just say anecdotally that since I started doing that outside of trials, I haven't seen any conjunctivitis occur. So one person's experience, but something to think about. I also get the recurrent question, how long do I have to be on this drug? And I know that Dr. Silverberg agrees because we've talked about this before, but we really want to keep patients on for at least a year. I think particularly in children, there's the potential for resetting the immune system by having this longer period of time, not just to give the patient a break, but also potentially to just change their skin and change their systemic immune reactivity. So I have found in patients who've been on it for a long period, who for some reason, maybe it's the insurance or for whatever reason, go off it for a while, that we can see patients go for months on end. These patients who couldn't go for a day or two without topical steroids, who can use a little bit of topical steroid and otherwise are doing so well.
Yeah, I will second and third both of those comments. So I too have been anecdotally giving patients, especially those who tell me they already have a history of allergic conjunctivitis, which we know these moderate severe atopics, about 25% of them probably already have some allergic conjunctivitis. I have all of them start from day one using those rewetting drops. And I agree, I've yet to really see issues develop. And I also get the whole, you know, when can I stop this? How long do I have to be on it? And I'm of the mindset, I want someone on drug probably for at least a year, but at a minimum, I want them, you know, doing really well, almost clear or clear for at least 5-6 months before we even consider stopping anything, which I tell them they probably will have to go back on some point, but maybe not. But no, I'm in complete agreement with that. You know, I think other great news that we share with our patients all the time is that there is this very rich pipeline that we've been dying for so long. And now it's multiple rows thick. To that end, Dr. Paller, what are you most excited about? What's coming down the pipeline or just in general in the world of atopic dermatitis?
At least for my children and adolescents, I'm really excited about having some alternative biologics. I don't know, for example, with the IL-13 inhibitors, if they are going to be ones that I can put my patients who maybe have not done as well as possible on dupilumab on and see different results, like we've seen with the biologics, how you can take one TNF inhibitor and it doesn't work, and you go to another and it works, and these are different in their mechanisms. So I'm going to be looking forward to seeing how we mix and match these various biologics. I have to say, I'm excited about the JAK inhibitors. I know there are risks and they're likely to have a black box warning. There's no question there's going to be lab monitoring. It's going to be a different discussion with the parents about safety, but I think they're also highly effective. I may not be using them as first-line agent for a while until I really get a better feel for that safety issue. Nevertheless, for those patients who haven't done as well as I'd like on dupilumab, I'm going to have to make some decisions based on experience with what I'm going to next, and it could be the JAK inhibitor.
Dr. Silverberg?
You know, I completely agree on all those points. I think for me, and maybe it's a little bit of a cop-out answer, I'll admit in advance, I'm excited by the sheer volume of options that are coming. I feel like as a clinician, we always want to have options to offer our patients. You know, you have topical JAK inhibition, you have oral JAK inhibition, you have, you know, new biologics that are similar to dupilumab but different. And I think it's all of those that really, you know, I think we have to figure out who the right patients are for each of these different types of drugs. But you know, to have a new advance in the topical space is certainly welcome. We haven't had any FDA approved oral options in the US. You know, cyclosporine is approved in Europe, but it's not approved in the US. So having an approved oral option is a great option. To see drugs that are more potent than dupilumab based on the head-to-head studies gives us the hope that we now have at least some drugs to use as a post-biologic in someone who may have an inadequate response. So I look at all of these and I see potential value for all of the different subsets of patients that I'm seeing. But I agree completely with Dr. Paller. Each of these are going to be very different. And you're really going to need to get comfortable as a clinician based on both the speed of onset, the potency, the safety, and then patient preferences about really identifying the right candidate drug for the right patient.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both so much for your time and your expertise. And most importantly, for the extraordinary contributions you've given our specialty. You know, I feel like I'm having a Wayne's World moment where we're not worthy. You know, we're like getting a chance to pick your brains about such a really difficult protean disease that affects so many of our patients. So really, for myself and the audience, thank you so much for being here with us.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
And thank all of you for joining us, and make sure to stay tuned for next month's JDD podcast.
You've been listening to JDD podcast, Ask the Investigator, the number one podcast for dermatology pearls. Our host is Dr. Adam Friedman. The podcast is produced and edited by Emily Lynch Fries. Our theme music is Designed for Life by Young Presidents. New episodes are available the first Friday of every month. Check us out at jddonline.com/podcast or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you want to talk to us about this or any other episode, email us at info@jddonline.com. Subscribe and review the podcast on iTunes or Google Play, and don't forget to catch our next episode. Thanks for listening.